So our next speaker is Mike Columbus from the Harvard Medical School and various places around there.
So good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for the chance to talk to you today. I think this talk is going to align very nicely with your discussion of HealthyLink. And what we're going to consider today is, now that you have that beautiful access, that wealth of data, how can you, or what additional ways you can use to make it useful for public health surveillance. This is going to be a very nice elision. So first of all, just we'll take a step back for a moment and consider, what are some of the limitations of traditional reporting processes for STDs? We'll consider then the differences between ELR versus electronic health record-based reporting, what's the pros and cons of each, and then tackle the challenge of case identification, automated case identification using electronic health record data. Let me take a quick aside to say that I'm giving another talk on Thursday that's devoted more towards systems and structures for tracking diseases across populations, and sort of how you can get population-level estimates and address some of the very, I think, prescient concerns that you shared. So this is focusing more just on the particular issue of case identification. Okay, so some limitations of traditional surveillance reporting. As you know, better than I do, no doubt, that the way that traditionally surveillance was done is you relied upon a well-meaning doc to remember they had an obligation to report, to know how to report, to find the piece of paper or the telephone number or the fax number or the web address, to actually fill out the information and then send it forth. And as we know, this is a practice better observed in the breach than in the observance. And this has been well described by many writers over time over here. So here's just a summary of a few different notifiable diseases. And as you can see, there's great variability in the completeness of reporting and typically a great lag from the time of case detection until it actually gets reported to the health department. So then along came the great innovation of about 20 years ago or so of electronic lab reporting, which was wonderful. And with similar paper from 2008 from Indiana over here showing that with electronic lab reports, you got a tremendous increase in the number of reports that you got and a tremendous improvement in timeliness, so a decrease in average time from case detection until reporting by 8 days. So electronic lab reporting was a tremendous step forward for public health surveillance, but it's not perfect, right? There are limitations to ELR. And some of those include that often it is missing the contact information for the patient or the clinician. It can report a purely clinical diagnosis. For example, pelvic inflammatory disease, perhaps a clinical diagnosis of syphilis is based upon exposure and a typical presentation. There's no data on symptoms, on pregnancy status, on whether or not the patient got treated. It cannot integrate multiple tests to yield a diagnosis. So an example of this might be a distinction acute HIV case and an acute hepatitis B or C case from chronic disease. It generates multiple reports for the same episode. So again, if it's HIV surveillance, you're going to get, every time the patient gets a viral load test, you'll get another report. Oops. That's enough limitations for now. Okay. Sometimes just go on and on and on. But see, I had a little control this time. And so what can electronic health records offer us? Can it give us any additional kind of gain beyond that? And so the core principle over here is that with electronic health records, it has all that lab data, so you can get what you can get from the lab, plus you have the patient demographics, the contact information for the clinician, the clinician's diagnoses, the vital signs, the pregnancy status, prescribed treatments, possibly signs and symptoms, depending on exactly how you try to gather it. It's equally timely, it's equally electronic and analysis ready. And excitingly, you have the potential also to set up a two-way communication structure. So for example, if you knew that there was an increase in the prevalence of an antibiotic-resistant gonorrhea in certain communities or in certain population groups, perhaps you could insert that information into the time of the encounter to advise the clinician. But they're not a panacea. So before I go on to describing all the wonderful things about them, I'll just take a quick sidestep over here to show that there are limitations. First of all, diagnosis codes are used variably and unreliably. Docs are not in the business of coding, and therefore they do it poorly. Symptoms and exposures can be documented variably. So you only see documented what the doc chose to ask and what they chose to write down. And when they do actually take the time to ask the question and to write down inside their record, it's often just plain old free text, which makes it tougher, although not impossible, for the computer to read and to aggregate. If a patient is getting care from multiple different providers, say a hospital and a clinic, a specialty clinic like an STD clinic and their primary care doctor, their data might be split between all those different kind of sources, and no one EHR might have all the information, so you can get an incomplete picture. And finally, EHRs, of course, have not yet reached 100% penetration of our populations. That's rapidly changing. So in some states now, the EHR usage rate is up to 90%, amazingly enough, due to federal incentives. But it's still not at 100%, and there's still a gap between having an EHR and actually making it available for public health. What I'd like to talk about most of all about today is the challenge of case identification. I alluded to the problem with ICD-9 codes, that they're used variably and often inaccurately. So here from some of our own work is an analysis of some of the sensitivity and positive predictive value of ICD-9 codes for a few key diseases. And you can see there's quite a wide range over there in the sensitivity. For certain conditions like tuberculosis and syphilis, people seem to be better about making sure that they document, but they're poorer when it comes to chlamydia. And the positive predictive value varies correspondingly. So the positive predictive value for chlamydia is pretty good, but the positive predictive value for tuberculosis and syphilis is bad. Why is that? Because often the docs will code for remote disease. So latent tuberculosis infection or tuberculosis infection when the person was 20 years old and they're now 80 will still often get coded inside the record, because that's important for the doc to know, but it's very confusing if you're trying to do public health surveillance using an ICD-9 code. So we believe that ICD-9 codes are not sensitive or specific enough to do identifiable case-based reporting. Laboratory tests, of course, is the other potential avenue that one could take. We've already alluded to some of the limitations of laboratory tests. Again, you're blind to purely clinical diagnoses. It's a poor discriminator between acute, resolved, and acute and chronic disease, and multiple reports. So these two axes over here of lab data and ICD-9 data both have their strengths, but also both have their weaknesses. Our hypothesis in Massachusetts has been that an approach to overcoming those limitations is to take the full richness of the electronic health record to aggregate and to integrate all the clinical clues that might be inside the record. So it's not just the ICD-9 codes and the laboratory tests, but also the prescriptions, for example, which are great clues to what the doc was thinking about the patient. If the doc felt that the patient actually had disease, they will treat. If they didn't, they won't. Laboratory orders, which give you a clue as clinical suspicion, even if you don't get laboratory confirmation of the disease, because we know the labs are imperfect. Vital signs, so on and so forth. So we try to integrate these together using custom algorithms that are purpose-built for every condition of interest, to try to enhance the sensitivity and the positive predictive value of surveillance to make it good enough to actually be doing identifiable case-based reporting. So for a disease like chlamydia, it's straightforward to actually find out who has a case or not. You simply have to find the chlamydia test and find a positive result. This slide's interesting because this is showing just a fraction of the range of chlamydia tests that are available inside of one of our practices. So there is actually real work to be done from an informatics mapping point of view, as to identifying all the relevant tests and teaching the computer that these are all chlamydia tests. But from a case identification point of view, it's straightforward. Let's take something a little bit more complicated. This is acute hepatitis B, which has to be the example I have worked up over here. I've done similar work for acute hepatitis C. And just to walk you through the development of an integrated algorithm for surveillance, let's just take a look together. So, our first starting strategy might be to say we'll use the ICD-9 code. And so what we did is we took every person who had an ICD-9 code for, in this case, acute hepatitis B. We did a random selection of 50 charts with the ICD-9 code, and we reviewed those charts to see if they met CSD, CDC case criteria for acute hepatitis B. Positive predictive value was zero. Okay. So what's going on over here? It's this issue again that the docs are not coding for you. They're coding for themselves. And in our case, the docs are using the same code for chronic hepatitis B and acute hepatitis B. Because there's so many more chronic cases than acute cases, it overwhelms any signal that you might have had from the acute cases. So that was no good. So our next strategy said, let's take a lab-based strategy. We'll take patients who have elevated liver function tests and a positive hepatitis B surface antigen. Okay, so this sounds better. And it's a substantial improvement over ICD-9 codes, but still not perfect. The key problem over here with this particular strategy is that chronic hepatitis B can sometimes flare and lead to a hepatitis. And so the false positives here are from chronic disease. Our next strategy said, okay, let's see what else we can do. What else can we find inside the electronic health records that helps us know if this is really a new case or an old case? So if the patient has ever had a prior positive test for hepatitis B, eliminate the case. If the patient has ever had an IC9 code for chronic hepatitis B, eliminate the case. Again, much improved, but the problem over here is that you might have chronic hepatitis B. This might be your first presentation to our clinical practice, so we might not have access to your old IC9 codes and your old hepatitis B surface antigens, so we need something more. We finally made a clinical observation, which is that the flare of acute hepatitis B is often associated with jaundice, with yellowing, whereas flares of chronic hepatitis B are often not. So we added in a laboratory marker for jaundice over here, in this case total bilirubin above 1.5. Finally, we got to a decent place. So positive predictive value of 97% with a sensitivity of 99% and specificity of 94%. And so that then is the actual algorithm we're using for operational surveillance for acute hepatitis B in our system. Here's the summary, the full algorithm. And just to give some flavor of what this gives you relative to an ELR-based report. So this is an analysis over here from a couple of years' worth of surveillance in our practice over here. During this time period, there were 2,500 positive test results for hepatitis B that only actually represented 600 unique patients. Okay, so if you have an ELR-based surveillance system, you can de-aggregate those yourself. That's okay. But what you get if you do this ESP EHR-based surveillance strategy is it'll actually pull out the needles in the haystack, those 8 acute cases, from 593 chronic cases. And so again, if you're a health department trying to find those needles in the haystack that best inform the leading edge of the epidemic, who needs outreach, who needs contact, HBIG, whatever the case may be, this is going to help you. We've done similar work for other diseases. So here's an example of our integrated algorithm here for syphilis. And you'll see that, as before, it takes into account IC9 codes, treatments, as well as laboratory tests. So I'll give you a quick flavor of here of putting this system into practice. We've developed a system in UC Massachusetts in Ohio called ESP, that's Electronic Health Record Support for Public Health, which is software and architecture to extract, analyze, and transmit electronic health information from providers to public health. It's designed in principle to be compatible with any kind of EHR system. We have three live installations in Massachusetts, one in Ohio. All told, in Massachusetts now we have about 1.25 million patients, which is about 15% of the state population under coverage. And we've reported now literally tens of thousands of cases of different kinds of notifiable conditions to the respective health departments in Ohio and Massachusetts. We've done some comparisons of the electronics-based surveillance strategy compared to conventional manual reporting. And you can see over here a substantial increase in the number of cases that are reported. And over here is some glimpses of some of the changes and the additional information that we get. So pregnancy is reported much more frequently, treatment details are reported much more frequently, and, of course, a elimination of transcription errors. And let me give my thanks to my many colleagues at various state health departments, my own department, and we entertain questions.
So thank you for that. I'm Robin from New York City, and we are just starting to get conversations going about EHR reporting and how we can sort of implement this. And I guess I'm just a little confused about you were using your ESP framework on EHRs that already existed.
Again, my talk on Thursday is going to be more about sort of building, putting together the bricks to build the systems in which you can actually use these algorithms. But what we have in a nutshell is that we have partnerships with three large practice groups inside of Massachusetts, one in Ohio, who had existing integrated electronic health record systems that already captured comprehensive diagnosis, prescription, demographic, et cetera, information. We locate this ESP system inside their firewall, which takes their information, applies these algorithms to find cases of interest, and then sends secure reports over to our state health department. There are a number of kind of technical approaches to implementing this. And again, that Thursday's talk will cover some of those. But that's basically where we began with. So in New York City, you have the hub, right, based on eClinicalWorks?
We have a variety of different EHRs, and eClinicalWorks is definitely one of the bigger ones.
Yeah. So the kinds of system that we're talking about can be integrated into a health information exchange as well. We have actually done that once in Massachusetts. So there are approaches that can be taken to putting this into practice.
It's Anita Barry from the City Health Department in Boston, and thank you, Mike, for a wonderful talk once again. I had two quick questions for you. In the acute hepatitis B, is there a reason you didn't look for core IgM?
Yeah, great question. So you would say right at the top of your head that core IgM is kind of the way to go for acute hepatitis B. It's clinically is diagnostic. What we found is that in practice, a lot of providers are confused about the different kinds of hepatitis B tests because there's so many of them, and that often the Hep B core IgM is simply not ordered. So we actually do have a separate study, which I'd be happy to send you, sort of characterizing what's the performance of core IgM versus these alternative strategies.
Thank you. And the one other quick question is the increase in case numbers, which was quite striking. It said manual versus ESPNet. Does that mean electronic health record comparing to ESPNet or piece of paper compared to ESPNet?
So what we did in practice, you'll know the people I'm talking about, is that in Atrius Health, which is a large multi-specialty provider practice, they actually do have a dedicated infection control nurse there whose job is to do reporting on behalf of the practice. We took their, for a defined period of time, all the cases they had reported manually through that system and through providers reporting themselves, and compared that to what we found at the ESP. And in practice, we did that by having the state health department pull for us all the reports for these diseases that were associated with that practice, and then simply comparing what ESP found and doing one-to-one matching.
So I suspect if you had compared to ELR, the increase would have been not quite so high.
Well, those cases would be included in ELR for the state health department records.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Make it really quick.
Okay, and it's a really quick question, and it might, I guess, be covered in your talk that you were talking about on Thursday. My name is Lauren Young, and I'm from the Arizona Department of Health Services. In our STD control program right now, we currently only use ELR with our database. We have a web-based database system, and one of the issues that we've had with ELR is every new lab that we put on, we have to kind of recreate the mapping system for how HL7 information is going to be inputted into our system. And so I was wondering, do you run into the same issues with electronic health records, especially since there's so many different types of EHRs out there? And how cumbersome is that when you're creating a system that you want to ideally just have plug and chug information in all the right spaces in your database?
Yeah, it's a terrific question. It's one of the real piece of work to getting this done. What you basically have to do is on a practice-by-practice basis, you have to identify what all their tests are for your conditions of interest, map it to something that ESP, in our case, can recognize, as well as map it to whatever format the health department wants to receive that lab in. So when we first implement these systems in each practice, there's an initial substantial investment to get that done in sort of time and energy. And then thereafter, what we do is we automatically survey every new lab test that comes into the system to see if it might be relevant to one of our ESP conditions. And if so, it sends an alert to an administrator who then updates the mapping to include that new lab. But it's a chunk of work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.